Joe.
Hey, Charles.
How you doing, man?
Great. How are you?
Excellent.
Continuation of our last discussion. So last time we talked about the test parallel library, which gives you kind of imperative parallelism. So you can do parallel for loops. You can create new task objects. You can do data flow parallelism with futures. And we showed you the whole fancy work scheduling that you use, the work stealing runtime. So that's the work stealing stuff is more of an infrastructure level thing. The APIs on top of that for parallel for loops are, you know, that's a more higher level API that people would actually use in their programs. Today we're going to take a look at parallel link, which is an implementation of link to objects that actually takes your queries and parallelizes them. And it's actually nice for a couple of reasons. We like to call this declarative data parallelism instead of imperative. Because you basically, you know, the way link queries are written, it's very similar to SQL, right, where you're kind of declaring what you want to happen. But just like SQL, you don't have to know whether it's laid out in indexes and, you know, whether there's B-trees involved and all this nonsense. You just kind of say what you want, and SQL is responsible for executing it as efficiently as possible.
Absolutely.
So PLink takes advantage of that declarative nature to parallelize.
Cool. So who do we have with us today?
So we have Igor.
Igor.
Yes, hello.
How are you, man?
I'm Igor Ostrovsky. I'm a developer on PLink. That's the project that Joe was just talking about. It's kind of his project. He started it. I joined Microsoft and started working on it as a developer.
Outstanding. So let's talk. Let's step back a second. So Joe, this is you started PLink. It's the project you started.
Yeah.
Right on.
I guess back in 2005. So this whole parallelism thing started to become a hot topic, and people were scrambling trying to figure out what to do. And Link was just kind of hitting an inflection point where it was starting to get a lot of adoption. And it, you know, seemed like a good idea to parallelize link queries. So
certainly
started out as a prototype, and then I think people out there have heard of Bill Gates' Think Week. This will be his last one coming up in a few months before he leaves the company. But I submitted a Think Week paper, and he basically said,
cool,
good idea, and now we're doing it. So.
Right on. That's pretty awesome, man.
Yeah.
Nice. All right, so let's dig in a little bit.
Okay.
You know, what is PLink? Let's talk about it.
Well, I'm going to let Igor describe everything. I figured I'll tee it up and just try to bridge the gap with the last discussion we had.
Perfect.
Let me just grab the marker. So if you remember last time, we were talking about things like parallel for loops and parallel for each loops that are built on top of this work scheduling runtime.
Yeah.
Right? And even lower level things like constructing task objects and waiting on them, canceling. So constructing big parallel programs that use these things, while it's certainly more convenient than if you were to write it all by hand, there's still a lot involved. So just to take one example, say so you have an integer array over here, and for whatever reason, you want to filter out all the elements that don't match a certain criteria. So maybe you have func of bool, basically just a predicate, func of int bool. And what you want to do is loop over A and filter out all the elements that don't match this predicate. Well, it turns out this is incredibly parallelizable, because to figure out whether any particular element matches the predicate or not, it's completely independent of all other elements in the array. So you might say parallel, I don't think we showed this last time, but there's a for each, which is very similar to a parallel for, as you might imagine. And so what this will give you is the elements in the array. So what you might want to say here is the lambda delegate, which is basically the body of the loop. You might want to say if p of E, then do something. You know, it matches the criteria. The problem is, what are you going to do? You know, are you going to add it to another array? So if you want to add it to another array, well, unfortunately, this body is running in parallel. So you can't just have a list of int results here, because you would have multiple threads trying to add to results here. So if you said results.addE, to gather up all the matching elements, this would be really bad to write. So we don't want to see this. There are other clever solutions, like you may have an array of Booleans, and you'll mark the elements that correspond to the elements you saw in A. Mm-hmm. This is kind of like a MapReduce. So first you would map the predicate based on the input array into an output array, and then you'd have to reduce that somehow down to a smaller array. But once you start venturing into this realm, mm-hmm. you know, it's clear that there's a little bit more involved than just writing a simple parallel for each loop. You actually have to think about synchronization between threads and being clever about it. So instead of doing this, obviously, if you want to do a where statement in link, I mean, it's pretty simple, right? You would say int b a, and then you would say where p of b to array. That's it. You've basically just written what you were trying to do here in nice. Effectively one line of code. So what plink does is it does what we were trying to do here, mm-hmm. introducing parallelism into these kinds of operations. Basically, you just make one small change, which is this extension method as parallel, which takes any enumerable of t. And then once you do this, it binds to the plink version of link, and it automatically parallelizes from there. And you know, it supports many other operators. This was just meant to be an illustration.
Very cool.
So I think that motivates it. And then, you know, obviously, how we implement all these things, like parallel sorts and joins and group bys and mm-hmm. anys and alls and counts and sums, all these are, it's pretty interesting. So
absolutely.
Igor can
that's what keeps Igor busy.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, actually, performance and reliability are really important components to the system that we spend a lot of time working on. So actually, a lot of our time goes to performance tuning as well.
I bet. But.
Okay. So I'll keep going with this problem. It is there's actually quite a few realistic problems that match this type of pattern. For example, you could imagine that this would be, instead of having an array of integers, you could have an array of photos, and you're looking for photos that contain a particular face, so then the P would be a predicate that would tell you whether the photo contains the face, or it could be stocks, and you could be looking for stocks that exceed some threshold, or a lot of other real-world problems. Okay, so Joe gave here the parallel query in plink. Let's kind of think about what needs to happen when plink executes this query, or if you were to implement this yourself.
Sure.
I would do something like that. Mm-hmm. So let's say that my input is start out with some integer array, so let's put some numbers here, 3, 1, 2, 5, and 6. Those are good numbers. And what you want to do is you need to split up the input so that multiple threads can work on in parallel, so that you have different cores splitting up the work. Mm-hmm. For example, I'll assume two cores just because it makes the picture simpler, but it's pretty easy to see how this would extend to more than two cores. So we'll split this up into, for example, 3, 1, 2, and 5, 6. And then we'll have one thread working on this partition of the input. And it will execute the predicate or compute the work that needs to be done for each element. And then we'll have thread 2, which is working on the second partition. And at some point, the threads are working on the inputs and producing some outputs. So
sure.
they're placing it into some sort of a data structure. And at some point, we have to put it all together.
Mm.
Because the rest of our program is kind of sequential. So I'm going to put this all together. And we'll have the thread that initially started in some fashion pick up the results, either as an array in this case, or iterate over it in a for each loop. So we can say that this is the consumer thread. So this whole picture has kind of three distinct things that need to be done, like three different tasks. Mm-hmm. One of them is the partitioning step. That's what happens here. Then we have the query execution, which is where we are doing the real work.
Mm-hmm.
And then we need to merge the results. So that's the...
the join or the...
Right.
Merge sort or whatever.
I'll call it merging results, cool. But any of those other things would work too. So this is kind of what you'd have to do if you were to implement it yourself. This is also what Peeling does. If you were to implement this yourself, it would be it gets pretty messy because you need to split up the array, and you need to queue works on the thread pool. You need an event, some interlog decrements to keep track of how many threads are still running, and when can you actually signal that you're done.
Yeah,
there's a lot of things also to go wrong.
There's a lot of ways to make mistakes.
Right, that's the main point. That's the main point.
Especially, I mean, and of course, you guys aren't relying on the thread pool. You're using TPL, right?
Yes.
Which implements a more intelligent threading. I shouldn't say more intelligent, should I?
Sure,
why not? Okay, continue. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
It turns out, too, that initially, this basic architecture looks fairly straightforward, and even with the difficult things that Igor mentioned, mm-hmm. you know, if you understand concurrency, it's, you know, you can implement that. Mm-hmm. It turns out that some of the more difficult problems we didn't even realize until we got, you know, deep into the implementation. Like, one really pervasive thing that that we didn't realize would be as pervasive at the beginning is the fact that Link has a strong notion of ordering, right? Mm-hmm. So if you want to query an array and scale the elements within the array by some constant, and then you shove that into another array as the output, you probably want the ordering of the elements to remain the same.
Sure.
And how do you do that when you're doing all this partitioning and all of this kind of query execution in the middle? That's a really tricky problem.
Absolutely. Good, fun things for Igor to work on.
Yes, this is very exciting. So, particularly, if you look at this picture, we have this consumer thread that is picking up elements and the threads that are generating them, mm-hmm. and we have to put them together.
Yes.
So if the order in which the consumer thread picks up the results doesn't matter, it is a lot more efficient for the threads to just kind of shoot out the results and for the consumer thread to pick them up regardless of trying to reestablish the order based on how the inputs were relatively ordered.
Okay.
So, the order preservation turned out to be an interesting issue, and we have decided to make it an opt-in, opt-out feature, because there are many cases where you actually don't care in which order you get the results, like the images that I was talking about earlier, that kind of scenario. But there are also many cases where you do care about the order of results. So we're still working out the best semantics for how the user should ask that they want order, and what exactly does it mean, and how precisely it's specified on the query. It's
challenging.
Yeah, it's pretty tricky to come up with like all the logical rules so that it's easy to use and intuitive, and also so that it's a small set of rules so that it's possible to remember them all.
So I have a question about the partitioning layer.
Mm-hmm.
How do you go about determining, for example, you're not going to know until something starts executing whether or not it could be a long-running task.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could therefore partition hitting the core that's kind of free to do work maybe faster or whatever. It's a hardcore computation.
Mm-hmm.
So in the partitioning phase, you guys have to think about how you're going to partition across cores based on
right.
the computation that needs to be done, right?
Yeah.
So how do you do that?
Well, so we do our best. We have we have a few different partitioning methods. Mm. One is range partitioning, which is what was applicable to arrays or lists, as in lists in .NET, basically arrays, where you can index into the data structure, and then we just basically can split up the array into equal chunks or as close to equal as possible. It has the advantage that it's low overhead because the threads don't have to communicate which thread is picking up which elements. Mm. But it doesn't have good load balancing properties. If there's a huge variation in how much work there is per element, then one thread may end up doing more work than the other threads. So it doesn't end up as good parallelization. Mm. There's also chunk partitioning, which is applicable either to arrays or to enumerables that are not arrays. And the way it works is that the threads are kind of asking for chunks of input to work on. So in this case, the thread one would say, "Okay, I'm ready," and it would take a lock, some sort of lock on a sort of data structure, and would get a chunk of elements, and then thread two would get a chunk of elements, and that way, some load balancing happens at least on the chunk level. Mm. So currently, if you use an array as an input, or an ILIST, we are going to use range partitioning. And if you use something that is not an ILIST, we're going to use chunk partitioning.
Okay.
It is an interesting trade-off, and definitely something that I think we need to think about whether we should somehow allow the user to request a more load balancing version of partitioning.
Interesting. I could see interesting connection with Volta in terms of tier splitting. Where you could actually direct onto individual cores. But that's a whole different topic. That's not really pertaining to today. But anyway, let's talk quickly about in terms of just because I guess the reason I asked that question was to sort of address a potential confusion that may exist with thread stealing. Mm-hmm. We talked about in TPL.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that during execution, that just happens. Mm-hmm. So this guy's ready for more work here. Steal it, do it. So I just wanted to talk from the partition phase, when of course is before execution happens, and you don't have access to this notion of thread stealing, right?
Right. Well, so as you said before, PLink, our first CTP, PLink actually wasn't built on top of the test parallel library, which is interesting, and people might wonder why that is. In fact, we documented that in the CTP release notes. The basic reason was PLink has been going on for a few years now. I say, it started in 2005. We have a pretty mature code base at this point. And the test parallel library, we only kind of brought down, we talked to Dan, right? Mm-hmm. And he was doing his research, and that only really produced results sometime 07, 06. Okay. So PLink had gotten a head start on TPL. So we're actually going through the exercise now of moving PLink on top of TPL. So the next CTP that people get their hands on, likely they
right
will
on.
Be unified, which should be there. I mean, people will expect that, right? Because we want to make sure everything's using the same work scheduler, everything's not fighting for resources across the machine. And so there's, conceptually, the way PLink partitions is very similar to how you partition a for or a for each loop with the parallel APIs.
Okay.
And so a lot of the benefits you see there, potentially, you would also see in PLink.
Sure. Excellent. So, now, one of the things that Dan actually stressed in our last discussion consistently was that the notion of maybe parallelizable, right?
Yeah.
So we may parallelize this execution context, or we may decide for it. In this case, if you use parallel link, you don't have that same sort of metaphor. I mean, from the outset, the developer's saying, parallelize this. Right?
Well, because we're using the same work stealing runtime, the same benefits apply. So if the machine's already loaded, and even though PLink internally is generating tasks, Let me just draw a little diagram. The way I think about things, I view it as we have the work stealing runtime down here. And then obviously, this is kind of an implementation detail, and what you see up here is the task API, right? And so there are many other things built on top of the task API. There's parallel, right? We talked about the other day, parallel is not special. You could implement it yourself using the task APIs. Mm-hmm. So a parallel really is just a thing that generates tasks for this work stealing runtime.
Okay.
P-Link, similarly, is just, doing it in a very clever way, but it's a thing that generates tasks in this work stealing runtime. They're all going down to the same runtime, so it has global knowledge into everything that's going on above it.
Excellent.
And just like in parallel 4, when you say parallel.4, it doesn't need to run in parallel. Mm-hmm. When you say use plink, it doesn't need to run in parallel. The same benefits apply. And similarly, you get the same benefits of having a unified cancellation model, a unified exceptions model, waiting. They compose nicely. So if you have a TPL for loop, and then within that for loop, you go off and execute a plink query, that's going to actually work as you'd expect.
Interesting.
So that's one of the advantages to unifying on one single runtime.
Very cool. Absolutely.
Mm. And so kind of back to the question quickly. Mm. And pretty much in these APIs, in all of them or in most of them, we don't guarantee that the work will actually be parallelized. It's possible that it will be run sequentially if there is very little work or it just doesn't.
So there's
not a parallelizable workload.
Is there any way? I mean, so to me that sounds like non-deterministic parallelization. So what if I want it to be? What if I say, look, I want this to run in parallel, period, man. I don't want you guys to decide whether or not it needs to happen. I might want this computation to be done, three times faster than there's nothing here that you may determine is special to parallelize, but I want you to parallelize it, man, because I want this computation to run three times faster. Now, you could argue, but how the hell are you going to know that there's going to be a core availability on all systems that you're running on? So I kind of get what's going on, but is there a notion of deterministic parallelization, which doesn't really make sense if you have one core? What are you guys going to do? So yeah.
It's a hard problem, and you still have threads today, right? So if you want to go back and use static work distribution and use threads, you can still do that. But we think that hiding a lot of that and using a more dynamic system is actually going to provide a lot of value.
Sure.
Well, is that to say that there will never be a case where somebody really wants to say, run this on four cores, no matter, I don't care about your heuristics and your intelligence in your system. I actually want it to run on four cores. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that situation will come up, but, we haven't actually run into it yet, including in our own development. So.
Right, but so the way to address it is to kind of add fine-tuning options to the API. So, for example, for TPL... you can specify on a task manager how many threads it creates, right? In P-Link, we also have options where you can specify how many partitions you want to create. So we try to give the developer the kind of control we think they'll need. Mm. If they really want to create their own threads and micromanage precisely what happens, instead of just kind of trying to get a good performance, then they can do that. But
sure. Then it begs the question, then why would you use this library?
Right.
I get it. I understand.
Right. So no single library is a solution to everything, but we think that the abstraction that we provide is a good trade-off between a good compromise between the usability, between the ease of use and the power of how much you can fine-tune.
Totally, man. I mean, I think that's definitely the case. So, without me sidetracking you guys more, let's continue to dig into this. So, where are we now?
So, I think a few interesting areas. There's so many areas to dive into. Maybe we should figure out which ones to go.
Okay, sure.
So, we already talked about partitioning. We talked about range. Kind of skipped over the fact that there's this variant on range called striped partitioning, which may or may not be interesting. There's chunk partitioning. Hash partitioning is probably maybe an interesting one to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Merging, more specifically, execution of the query.
Okay.
There's some interesting things here, like we have this for all API, which actually skips merging altogether for cases where you don't need to merge in it.
Hmm.
Because if you look at the diagram Igor drew, you know, it's obvious that the two independent kind of stovepipes where the threads are executing, those really aren't synchronizing. They're not communicating. And so the synchronization happens at the partition and the merge phase, and that's where you're going to have impact to scalability. Aside from that, most operators scale perfectly, aside from, you know, there's always cache effects and other effects on the machine, but for all skips one of the two expensive synchronization steps. There's for all, we have async merging, which is used for, you can control this, but it's used by default when you request an enumerator instead of saying like to list, for example. There's synchronous merging. I can't remember what we call these, though. This is in our documentation. We actually call these like stop and go. What is this one called?
Pipelining.
Pipelining. And then third, there are some query operators that are kind of interesting. So sorts are particularly interesting. Group by, join. And there's a lot of things that we could dive into, but maybe we should just pick, you know, a couple of these and
sure. You could also talk about exceptions, side effects,
right.
Particularly bad queries.
Well, we talked about exceptions in the TPL. You did a pretty good overview of what kind of magic you guys have to do there with your with the new object you've created.
Yeah.
That contains multiple exceptions.
Yeah, for each exception.
You got it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we use the same exact model here, which is
nice. Which is goodness.
Right. Especially when we start talking about tool support, at least we have a common debugging story, common exception handling.
Well, let's geek out on hash partitioning to begin.
Okay.
So some operators, like, say the distinct operator, if you want to perform it in parallel, you need the partitioning to have a certain property. Say that you have two partitions, one partition which contains elements 3 and 2, and the other one that contains 2, 2, 4. If you compute distinct on this partition, you get 3, 2. And from this one, you get 2, 4. But obviously, you haven't done a... it's not correct, because you have the 2, which is in both partitions.
Mm.
But if the partitioning had a certain property, which is that the element with the same value is guaranteed to be in the same partition, so all 2s will be in a single partition, and all 3s will be in a single partition, then you can perform this work in parallel.
Mm.
You can do the distinct operation. There's other operations like joins, set operations, group by, that have this property. So this is where hash partitioning comes in. That is, if you have this kind of operator in the query, before we execute that operator, we are going to redistribute the elements so that, based on the hash key, so that elements with the same hash key are going to end up in the same partition.
Mm.
It is an interesting algorithm. I'm not sure whether we want to get into that.
Mm.
Sure. Why not?
Okay.
I want to see smoke coming out of your ears, man.
Yeah.
Smoke coming out of my ears. Okay, so we have... we're running out of...
we can go ahead and erase that.
That's
sure. That one, people should understand that by now.
Mm-hmm.
Even if I don't, I'm sure the smart niners do. So. All right.
Okay, so let's see. We have 4 threads which are executing. Well, 2 threads is easier. Any 4 threads is better. and they are producing some results. And we want to kind of repartition these results so that the hash partitioning property holds. So what do? We are going to have... We're going to create a matrix. And each of the threads is going to be assigned some hash key range. It doesn't have to be contiguous range, but some subset of hash keys that it will have after the hash repartitioning is over. And these four threads are going to, each thread knows, so each thread is producing some results, and it will assign the elements to the threads, to other threads, that will own the particular element after the hash partitioning is over. So, for example, let's say that thread 1 has 2 and 4, it will assign 2 to, for example, to thread 2. So it will place the 2 into here, into this index, into that square in the matrix. So the threads are kind of assigning the elements to the other threads. And once this is done, each thread will read the elements in the column that it has been assigned and continue from there. So it has kind of two parts. One is where threads assign elements to other threads, and then the second part where they pick up the elements that they were assigned.
Sure.
So this is kind of an interesting algorithm because it avoids synchronization as much as possible. Because in the first phase, threads can write into the matrix without synchronization. Because kind of each thread has its own column that it's writing to. Each row has its own row. And then when threads are reading, it's fine. They just read a column.
Interesting. And so the matrix, the number of columns, obviously, is dependent upon the number of threads.
Yeah, so the number of threads. So this is...
That's good.
Each column and each row represent the...
That's a clever way to get around synchronization. Huh?
There's one synchronization operation, which is when the threads are done inserting into the matrix, before they move on to the reading phase, they need to be sure that all of their threads are done writing to their particular column.
Okay.
Right. So there's a single kind of joint point, but all of these inserts are not synchronized.
So that couldn't be achieved by like a column that's dedicated to like a fifth column that could have a state bit.
Mm-hmm. It's effectively what we have.
Okay.
So the synchronization is constant, right? So this is the really nice thing is that in terms of the critical path of the application, so of course there's a synchronization operation per thread, but the critical path will only be one of those threads. And there's only one synchronization operation. So it's constant synchronization or constant time, if you will, O of 1, versus a more naive algorithm, which would be order however many elements you actually have to redistribute among partitions. Mm. And so you're only paying one instead of, you know, if you're querying 1,000 or 10,000 elements, that's quickly going to become a bottleneck.
Sure. Excellent, man. Right on, Igor. Mm-hmm. All right. So where to next?
I think it would be interesting to chat about the merging, types of merges.
I think
cool.
So. Yeah.
I think it would be useful to return back to this beautiful picture.
It's a great picture. I think that's P-Link in a nutshell right there. All right.
Okay, so this is a picture at a very high level, and there's a lot of stuff happening. And one interesting thing is to think about the timing. So do we first partition the elements, then complete the query execution and capture all of the output into the buffers, and only then let the consumer run through the elements? Or do we do it at the same time? Do we produce the results and pick them up by the consumer as they're getting produced? So this is where we get the two types of merges, synchronous merge, asynchronous merge, and synchronous merge. For example, if the query ends with a two array or a two list, the user is going to get all of the results as in a single data structure. So by the time that we return, they're going to get everything. So they don't really, there is no notion of like kind of picking them up one at a time. So in that case, we use stop and go execution or the synchronous merge. The threads will produce all the elements, store them in the buffers, and only then will give them to the user. Mm. The alternative is if the user iterates over the results with a for each. For example, if we have for each var x in q, and I have some body here, where q is a parallel query, it would be nice to be able to start executing this body as soon as even some of the elements in x are produced, rather than having to wait until the entire query is done.
Especially if it's an infinite enumerable data source.
Yeah, that is an excellent case when it's not a good time to wait for everything to be finished. Actually, but only some queries. We can do this only for some queries, because if the query ends with order by, we just have to. The query has to run in stop and go, because we can't start producing elements until we have all of them, we sorted them, and so the pipelining applies only for certain queries. On the other hand, those queries tend to be quite common, and the user has the ability to request stop and go by a parameter. So by default, we use pipelining whenever possible. And if the user wants to use stop and go, even though pipelining is possible, for example, to avoid, under some circumstances, it may be there may be less synchronization for the stop and go execution. So if the user wants to elect that, we have an overload of get enumerator.
So one of the things that immediately comes to mind is debugging. Mm-hmm. So if you're doing a pipelining merge and mm-hmm. something goes on, I mean, debugging into that would be, I'm just interested in asynchronous debugging.
Right. So the debugging experience is something that we're still looking into.
Sure. It's a
hard problem because you have multiple worker threads that are doing something and now they may throw exception, and by the time you can do anything, another thread throws an exception. So now you have these two exceptions at two different stacks. So it is an interesting problem.
There's some interesting research going on by Satnam Singh over in Cambridge. He's doing some asynchronous debugging asynchronous threads. Efficiently, so that you get meaningful information when you want it.
Well, it's a fundamental difference. Just as an example, say in this query that Igor wrote here, maybe you have a query up here that you've declared, var q equals from x in data source, where p of x, and then it goes on, right? But you set a breakpoint on this, just as an example. Mm-hmm. You want to see what's going on, and you execute this query via plink. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? It may not be obvious, but this predicate is going to run on multiple threads, and therefore your breakpoint is going to hit multiple times. It looks to you like you're just running in a single-threaded mode, but suddenly on a 16-core machine, you suddenly have 16 breakpoints hitting simultaneously, and you try to step through, and it's breaking on another thread, and it's apt to be pretty confusing. So we are definitely working hard on this, this problem.
So there have to be some sort of way to kind of take all the debugging information and put it into one thing. It's like you do sort of join it all into one comprehensible data structure.
Or a view.
Or something.
Right. That's one of the beautiful things about actually building, again, on top of this common scheduling infrastructure. Because if a debugger knows... my diagram went away. But
it's happening on another thread, man.
These whiteboards erase themselves from time to time. Well, yeah, so if a debugger knows about tasks, then it knows about plink, and it knows about parallel for loops, and it knows about all these things. And mm-hmm. so it allows us to more efficiently come up with solutions that apply to every technology in parallel extensions.
Outstanding. All right. Back on you, Igor. Where were we before I interrupted
you? Okay, so that was a bit of... So we were talking about types of merging, and there's another type of... I didn't mean that was a very interesting conversation sure. that we just had. The original topic was on merging, and
hey, this is a Channel 9 interview, man. You never know what direction it's going to go in.
That makes it very exciting. We talked about asynchronous and synchronous merging.
Yes.
Joe briefly mentioned how for-all merging works. So in the context of this diagram, if all that you have to do is for each produced result, you have to do some action that is safe to run in parallel, then we can kind of get rid of this whole merging part. We don't have to put the result into a buffer and then put them all together. We can just execute the action on the thread itself. Mm-hmm. So that is...
So I don't quite understand that. Can you step back for a second? So,
sure.
So, because, I mean, it still has to be a parallel construct, right, for all? Or what are you saying
yeah.
it's not?
So
can you give an example in the code, like...
Mm-hmm. So Joe had a query here earlier. I can erase this, right? Where you had a dot s parallel dot select dot where. And now, on the result that I produced, you can run some action that, for example, does its own synchronization or, for whatever reason, it's safe to run in parallel.
Okay.
Then we can do dot for all.
So this is instead of saying, you know, for each-ing over the query itself.
Okay.
Right. So this will actually run the query right away.
Okay.
And it has no return value. Dot for all, and then I can take my element... and called some sort of action. So in this case, we don't actually have to put all of the results together. We can just run action on this thread. Once it's ready to produce the result, it will just execute the action.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of does that instead of merging.
So each thread is responsible for executing the action on its subset of output elements.
Okay.
Right, right.
But I guess, yeah, so I guess what was confusing me was what happens down... That happens, but what does it mean to the consumer thread, right? Because you said that you're not merging anymore, but in fact
right.
you are. You don't need to.
Right, so it stops.
Got it.
So, in fact, if it's not obvious in this example...
Mm-hmm.
Thread 1 is often the consumer thread, right? So in the case of the asynchronous, the pipelining, the consumer thread is kind of detached. It goes off and spawns these other threads, and then it returns, and it has an enumerator that it can use to communicate with the other threads and get results back.
Mm.
In the stop-and-go case, the consumer actually helps produce output because it would be silly for the consumer just to block. I mean, it actually takes... part of the responsibility for producing output itself. Similarly, in the for-all case, it will join the party, if you will, and it will execute the actions on a subset, and then at the end it waits for all the other threads to complete. And so it looks like a synchronous API call, but internally, you know, it's fanning out and running in parallel.
Okay. So in a real-world example, when would I use for-all? Just to end the for-all discussion. So when would I use it?
Well,
you know, scenario based, you know, as a developer, when would I call for all?
So, say that you have an action. So, say that you are writing to a log file and you have a method that has its own synchronization.
Okay.
That would be one case. Or you're inserting into a log-free data structure, so you don't need synchronization. So you're inserting the results into a log-free data structure. Then you can use for all. Because it's safe to do. You don't have to synchronize before
Excellent.
You do that.
Okay.
There's also, don't use for all in the ray tracer example in the community tech preview.
That's another good reason.
A ray tracer, you know, actually has to update the pixels in a screen. So what it does is it selects all the pixels, and in the process it computes new values for all the pixels. Mm-hmm. But at the end, it uses a for all to stick them back into the buffer. And it knows, similar to a parallel for each loop, mm-hmm. or a parallel for loop, it knows that every action is independent from all others, i.e. it's not going to try to access the same element in the buffer. And so that's another example.
Right. That's a cool. Good example. Yeah.
Excellent. Synchronization or not synchronization.
Right.
Cool.
That's kind of, you know, synchronization by isolation.
Cool.
That works.
Absolutely.
Okay. So I think for the merging...
There's one variant, which is the order preserving merge.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, okay. So we can talk about that quickly. If we care about the output that the consumer thread is going to get, or the output ordering mm-hmm. that the consumer is going to get, then we have to reestablish the order here in the merge itself. There's two different sources where the ordering could be coming from. One is from the operators in the query. So if you have an order by in the query, we need to obviously order things before returning them, mm-hmm. order the elements. Another reason is if the user requests that they want the initial ordering of elements in the input to be respected. In that case, when merging the results, we need to reestablish the order based on how the elements were ordered initially. So, for example, if these threads just returned their own input, which is not a particularly useful computation, but for the example, then when we're putting these back together, we have to reestablish the same order. Now, in this case, it turns out to be pretty simple because you can just take this one and put all the other elements after it. But in other kinds of partitionings, it gets more complicated. Or if you have reverse or other operators in the query, then obviously there's
certainly
something we need to do there. And that can be, in the worst case, but we need to do a sort. Just because we need to sort all of these elements based on their original indices in the input,
mm-hmm.
but in other cases we can get away with doing a bit less work. This case is pretty extreme in that we almost in the ideal case we could just put those two together and that'd be it. So there's very little work to actually reestablish the order.
So now, in the case of order by and group by, order mm-hmm. by, that happens at the execution stage, right? And that happens at the mm-hmm. query stage, yes?
Right. So our order by, our sorts are late, lazy.
They're lazy. Oh,
right.
Eric Meyer
that's
would like
the
that.
Right term.
Okay.
We just associate the sort key with the results, and then we have to put them, the merge itself will... we'll do that. So it makes sense because in PLink we want to avoid the times when all the threads have to put their results together and wait for each other because that's a sequential step. That's where you're losing parallelism. So we do it once at the end in the merge.
Mm.
Whenever possible, we do it once. Right.
So I mean, what all this stuff with link like starts to make me wonder or question is. The relationship between the computation that's happening in a link query and the execution of said query and what mm-hmm. SQL does, mm-hmm. right? Now, clearly, SQL has a rather evolved, complicated, super efficient, incredible query execution engine.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they do for a living, and they can take all the resources of a machine.
Mm-hmm.
Did you guys work with them at all? Let's talk a little bit about that.
So... ironically, when the project was first getting started, one of the guys who was helping me out just on the side, he's an architect at the company, he was helping me, was actually the architect and then subsequent dev manager for SQL Server's query processing engine.
Uh-huh.
In particular, the parallel parts of it.
Nice.
And so SQL actually does parallelize query execution as well. Mm-hmm. And it uses a very similar model. And in fact, I worked with their dev lead to come up with some designs for a lot of the hash partitioning. And
cool.
And when I was doing the research for the project initially, it's kind of funny because you have a long history of people trying to parallelize data comprehensions in functional languages. So Haskell, for example, there's this thing called data parallel Haskell, which Simon Peyton Jones is involved in. It's very much like this, because in Haskell you have comprehensions where you can filter things, you can map things, and it turns out to look a lot like Link, and they use a lot of the same evaluation techniques that we use. But ironically, that community really hasn't talked with the database community, who also for the last 15 years has been researching and doing parallel execution of queries.
Uh-huh.
And so it was kind of interesting doing this work, because we had to pull together this disparate research, and effectively they were going in similar directions without even knowing it. So that was one of the fun parts of doing this.
Oh, wow, that's very, very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. So at some point we should talk about, dig into the query execution engine, the query processing engine, but I guess today, not today.
Yeah.
But it's definitely, I think people take for granted sometimes some of the amount of intelligent algorithms that are happening at that level. Mm-hmm. So that things happen correctly, quickly, etc.
Right.
Cool. So what's next, Igor? First of all, did you just get out of high school recently, or what?
Out of high school?
Finished so young, man. So you poached him right from college? Did they even let you finish college?
It's like basketball.
Kobe Bryant here.
Yeah, we gave him a car.
No.
So what's your story, man?
I'm a bit older than that.
It was a compliment. You look very young.
Oh, thank you.
So what's your story, man?
I finished undergrad degree at University of British Columbia, actually in May. And I came down here and started working with Joe in July, so...
Outstanding. Cool.
Yeah, I did a couple of internships at Microsoft on the Exchange Server team.
All right. And you knew you wanted to be an SDE, huh?
Yes, I did.
Cool.
That's my thing.
Well, you're definitely on a great project, because this is like the beginning of the future, right? The parallel computation. Good group.
It is, yes. I'm definitely enjoying my time.
Cool.
On the projects.
Yeah, you're staying pretty busy, I imagine.
Yes. I don't complain.
So you're writing most of the code that you write every day is C#, yes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pretty much all of it that I wrote is C#. P-Link is all managed code, so... Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
Yeah, we have other people on the team that are doing some native things, which I think... you have in the pipeline to talk to.
Good.
An architect on our team, Nicholas, that you should definitely chat with.
Cool. Well, there's native is going to be around for quite a long time.
Yes.
Since the system's all this run on, it's all native.
Yes.
Very cool. So let's shall we wind down here? What have we missed?
Well, we didn't really touch on the API level stuff and how queries are actually represented internally. It might make sense to do some of that. Just talk about how we have the query tree or the query graph, and then the execution tree that's built out of enumerators, if you will. It might be interesting just to give a little bit of an overview.
Sure.
Great.
We could do that.
Good. Okay. I think you can erase your beautiful picture if you need to. We have that recorded.
Okay. Everybody who's been watching the video already has the picture
they have
in their minds, so I can erase it.
Be careful in your erasure.
Yes, I have to do a precise job here. Okay, so let's look at this query. Maybe I'll get it up. Okay. So, let's assign the result to something. So the first step that we, in the query execution from the user's perspective, is that they start with some data source, they call sparl extension method, and then they call other extension methods, and these extension methods are getting bound to plink implementation, because sparl returns an iparallel enumerable, and all of these methods are overloaded that take an iparallel enumerable and return an iparallel enumerable. So all of these methods are going to be from the parallel enumerable class in plink as opposed to the enumerable class in link2object. And the return value of each of these calls is our internal abstract representation of the query. So when you call ARS parallel, you kind of get you get this empty. Well, I shouldn't talk to float. You get this empty kind of data source object, right? Short as a rectangle. It's very important.
Yes, of course. Must be, right?
It wouldn't work.
Or are you thinking a circle, man?
Sorry. This is our, say, parallel enumerable wrapper, or I'll just call it parallel wrapper.
With a W, not R-A-P-P-E-R.
Yeah.
Parallel wrapper, yeah.
Yeah, you know.
That. We need to extend plink to support that, too. when you call select, we're going to wrap this again with the select operator, and where it's going to wrap it with another operator. So we build up this abstract syntax tree, even though this is a very simple tree, and the queue is going to refer to this. There's this queue here. So this is what you're holding when you have queue. So none of this has executed at all. This is the array. This array that that the user originally passed in. And at this point, not much interesting has happened other than we've built up the abstract syntax tree. And the user calls getEnumerator at some point. In a for each loop. Well, okay, so they can call getEnumerator, or they can call one of the other methods, like toArray, or whatever, forAll, or all the other ones to look up. But let's look at getEnumerator, because that is kind of the most complicated one. So they'll say... q.getEnumerator... And nothing interesting still happens, because the interesting stuff starts to happen when they call move next on the enumerator. So typically you have, like, say, while loop. And the first time move next is called, that's when a lot of interesting stuff starts to happen. We start to execute the query. So we're going to create the different threads or tasks or however it's implemented, and start producing results for the query, start executing. It is possible that by the time you call the move next returns, the entire query has finished and is executed. For example, if there's a sort in the query, by the time this returns, you will just hold an enumerator to the buffer with all the results that have been produced in parallel and given to you. It's also possible that you just get an enumerator that points to a buffer that is being filled by the threads as they are producing results. And if this while loop is too fast, then this will block and wait until the next element is produced. Or the next batch of elements, or however it's implemented.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, kind of what happens here is, in the part of the diagram where I had the four threads, or two threads, that. So I have two threads that are producing results. What is happening in each one of these is that I have some. So the merge itself is driving the. So the way it's implemented is that I have some here internal that represents the computation, kind of like. A way to think about it is that the way link to object is implemented, you kind of have this enumerator that you enumerate, and it's producing results kind of on demand. So you could think about that kind of happening here, that each of the threads has kind of its own where enumerator that is linked to the select enumerator. And each of the threads iterates over this where enumerator and places the results into the buffer.
Excellent.
So you can think of it as kind of the two link queries executing parallel, and each one is being iterated over, and as they're being iterated over, we're putting the results together and making them available to the while loop.
Excellent. Cool. Very cool. Well, thank you guys. This has been another good lesson in what's going on in the parallel world, and we'll be here again.
Yep.
And we're going to keep on investigating this stuff. And good job, Igor.
Thank you.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. And, thanks for having a chance.
Sure. And this was a very good explanation. I think it's pretty clear to people out there what's going on here.
That's good.
Awesome. Thanks again.
Thank you.